The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. We know it is rather difficult to move any amount of attention away from Israel's aggression in Lebanon, its systematic attacks on Palestinians in occupied West Bank neighborhoods, its ruthless 13 months of genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip. For the sake of tonight's program, we have to. We have to highlight a genocide within a genocide, a cold, calculated, and unconscionable campaign of siege, massacre, and terror on northern Gaza for over 34 days now. Beit Lahia, Gaza City, and the Jabalia refugee camp. No food, medicine, supplies, or people are allowed in, and anyone who tries to escape is targeted by Israeli occupation forces, sniper fire. The UN humanitarian chief, Joyce Msuya, has warned the Palestinian civilians held under, quote, near total brutal siege by Israeli forces in northern Gaza are starving while the world watches. We'll discuss this and more in today's installment to your Spotlight. Joining us is Charlotte Case, International Coordinator at Samidoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver, Canada. And Clive Menzies, researcher and commentator, joining us out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to say hello and welcome to the both of you for joining us on the program. Thank you both. I guess we'll start with you, Charlotte, out there in Vancouver. Just today, over 30 people killed in the Jabalia refugee camp, at least a dozen, and it's still a developing story. Displaced at a school in Beit Lahia, killed mostly women and children in both instances. Your initial thoughts on this U.S.-Israeli war machine continuing its barbarism at this level, which seems also to make it even more grim, no end in sight.
I mean, the Zionist regime has always been genocidal in its nature. It has always been a genocidal project. It's always been a genocidal regime. And the United States, as an imperialist power, along with its fellow imperialist powers, has rushed to give billions and billions of dollars in weaponry to encourage the genocide. I mean, right now in the U.S. elections, despite clear polling data that indicated that the Democratic candidate would be far more popular if she took a stand against the genocide, instead, Kamala Harris, who lost the election, did everything that she could to advocate for more weapons and more money and more bombs to go to the Zionist regime. And so, you know, when we see that this is a genocidal regime that's carrying out a genocidal policy, they are trying to empty the north of Gaza of Palestinians. And these are people in the north of Gaza who have been displaced on multiple occasions, who were ordered to go to the south and told that there would be safety in the south. And then they were bombed and attacked in the south, and who have returned to the north to stay in their homes, to stay on their land, despite the fact that many of them are themselves Palestinian refugees who were expelled from their homes and lands by the Zionist regime during the Nakba in 1947 to 1948. They're refusing ongoing displacement, and continuing, therefore, to face this, outright, openly genocidal regime that is openly declaring in the media that it intends to prevent Palestinian civilians from returning to the north of Gaza. And just to be clear, I mean, they have always been outright, this has always been a war on the Palestinian population as a whole. This has been a genocidal aggression which targets homes, schools, places of displacement, mosques, churches, residential buildings. These are the targets of the Zionist regime. They have constantly been the target. They've always had the goal of attempting to seize more Palestinian land and destroying the Palestinian people, and they're continuing to do so. And so it really speaks to the fact that it's urgent for people around the world, particularly in the Imperial Corps, to not sit by and watch this continue to happen after over a year of ongoing genocide, and that it is only the forces of the resistance that are defending and protecting the Palestinian people and upholding their responsibilities under international law, under the Genocide Convention, to stop a genocide that has been taking place and is continuing.
Thank you, Charlotte and Clive. Welcome to the conversation. And I'm glad that Charlotte started with the fact that it's been decades of genocide at different levels, at different degrees, but it's been decades of genocide, ethnic cleansing, different shades of barbarity, but barbarism. But this, your initial thoughts, Clive, because sometimes still, even when you have decades of genocide in front of you, you have certain days where it's still a big punch in the stomach. When you have 30 people, when you have 12 people, when you have, like 3 weeks ago, we had in Beit Lahia, three residential buildings leveled with nearly 80 people, mostly women and children, perishing in one day. It's just really unfathomable, but yet it's happening too frequently for us to really bear.
It is. It's horrific. And one of the sad facts is that when one's exposed to this on a constant basis, and most of this is not seen in Western media, there does become a sort of familiarity with it, which somehow makes it less intense. But when you have the imagination and the understanding of what's actually going on, you cannot help but be revolted. But as I've said many times before, This is, as Charlotte has said, this has been going on for decades, and there is an agenda, and it is an agenda that comes from a structure which is driven by money, but also the ideology of destruction. On one level, this is a land grab, and looking to create pristine cities on the sort of 15-minute city model. But actually, when you look at the reality of what's been happening over the last 70 odd years, it is actually something much deeper than that. And one of the justifications for all this has been this idea that has been inculcated certainly into Western civilization's psyche, that somehow Israel is exceptional because it suffered such an horrendous atrocity during the Second World War. But the reality is that there is no documentary, physical, or chemical evidence that the narrative of the Holocaust stands up. And one of the facets of this ideology is that it inverts the truth, and it accuses those it accuses others of committing the sort of atrocities that it conducts itself. And if you study the work of the likes of Jurij Lina, who wrote Under the Sign of the Scorpion about the Bolshevik Revolution, there are similar atrocities that were committed in the Russian Revolution. This is something that is almost pathological in its nature. And because we have this mythology of the Holocaust, and you even have so-called Holocaust survivors claiming to be on the side of the Palestinians and being the voice of those who are being oppressed, they are part of the problem, because they continue to perpetuate this narrative of victimhood, which doesn't stand up to any sort of scrutiny. And that is, if you like, the narrative of the Holocaust is the linchpin that actually holds this structure together. And that this is not anti-Semitic, or is it not criticizing Jews, because they have been victims. They've been victims of the same pathological structure that has wrapped Jews around itself in order to protect itself. So you need to unwrap these layers for the benefit of Jews. And we need openness as to, one, what has happened in history, and two, what is currently happening. And what is happening now is clearly abhorrent. And there were similar atrocities committed across Germany with the firebombing of Belsen and Dresden and other cities, which were never actually fully disclosed in the aftermath of the war. That there was recognition to some extent, but they were doing the same on behalf of the same ideology, the same sort of atrocities against women and children and those seeking to escape the atrocities. There were similar atrocities undertaken. And so this is something that has been going on for a long, long time. And it's time for the world to wake up, one, to the reality of this ideology, and two, realize that this is not an exceptional situation in terms of what's been done over centuries.
Right, Clive, thanks. And Charlotte, and I want to put what Clive said to you. I mean, if Israelis enjoy that exceptionalism, and I'm not going to go personally as far as doubting the accuracy of Holocaust facts. Maybe Clive has been privy or abreast of some historical facts that I may have eluded me, and I'll accept that. But nevertheless, if it's granted that exceptionalism, does that mean it does not have to abide by any rules of engagement, any red lines for its violence, any care or compassion for women, for children, for non-combatant men, for elderly, for the sick?
So let's be very clear, the Nazi apologia aside, which really has nothing to do with the Palestinian cause and is an attempt to hijack the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian struggle to justify one faction of European imperialism from the early 20th century. The fact is that the Zionist Project has always been sponsored and supported by the imperialist powers. I mean, first by Britain, which issued the Balfour Declaration, because the Zionist Project has always been interested in being an outpost for these imperialist powers in the region, and throughout occupied Palestine, not just to attack the Palestinian people, but to essentially enable imperialist powers to continue to confiscate the wealth, resources, and labor power of the people of the Arab and Iranian region consistently in order to deny them self-determination and their future. So therefore, right now, the Zionist regime and its imperialist backers, they're willing to provide billions and billions and billions of dollars in weaponry, not to stop the genocide, not to halt it in its tracks, but to enable it to continue. The fact is that the Palestinian resistance, along with all the resistance forces in the region, has presented a clear challenge to imperialist domination in occupied Palestine and throughout the region. The resistance forces from Palestine to Lebanon to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Iran are confronting imperialism on the front lines, are confronting the attacks and the really just the most brutal forms of destruction, the burning of women and children alive, the rape and sexual assault of prisoners who have been captured, just the most horrific forms of violence against the Palestinian people. This is being paid for and sponsored because they view it as beneficial to them. And so therefore, it's only the resistance forces that are acting in a meaningful way to put a stop to this genocidal policy. These imperialist powers are not just standing by and letting it happen. They're sending them the bombs and the money in order for it to continue.
Right. And Clive, why does it seem the international community does not mobilize to do more? Why are they not moved by the atrocities in Gaza, even when you get really just astronomical numbers in one day that really turn most people's hearts and guts and souls Why do you, I mean, France said we're going to stop sending arms to Israel. They didn't. Spain said we're going to stop sending arms to Israel. We find out they didn't. Berlin said they're going to cut down. We see they really didn't. So, I mean, we get a lot of this double talk, but no one really takes any concrete action. We don't see sanctions. We don't see anything that will curb the regime's atrocities. Why?
I fear that the connection is not as good as it should be, but hopefully this will get through. I mean, essentially, one needs to understand who actually controls the power. And the power is controlled by those who control money. And to talk about the imperial project, there was the, if you like, the Anglo-American establishment, which came into being at the turn of the 20th century under Cecil Rhodes and his acolytes. That is effectively funded by the same sources that are funding the current genocide. And essentially, the Balfour Declaration was given to the Rothschilds in exchange for getting the US into the First World War. So all of the international organizations that you refer to, plus most of the Western governments, are under the same sort of power. So I've had a number of discussions where people suggest that Israel is, if you like, the imperial project of America in the Middle East. But actually, the reverse is true. American Congress is dominated by the same forces. You don't get into Congress unless you get the sanction of the Jewish/Israeli lobby, who effectively can remove people from power very easily. And this has been going on for a long, long time. So this, although the public face of imperialism may appear to be British, as it was in the first half of the 20th century, or American since then, this is actually the same ideology expressed through various, what seems to be, different forms of cosmetic front, for want of a better way of putting it. So in terms of where we go from here, the essential thing to remember is that we vote for our governments, and the whole business of election is in a distraction. And so the American election has been distracting opinion whilst this has been going on, but nothing is going to change under that. The only way things are going to change is when we stop paying our taxes, paying our rents, complying with the laws that make no sense to any of us, and withdraw from these structures that are actually conducting a war on us all, not just in Palestine, although obviously that's the most graphic and horrific expression of it, but it's going on everywhere through mass vaccination, through chemtrails and poisoning people, through our food, through so many vectors. We are the victims of this, the people of the world, and it is the power structure that is perpetuating this. And the only way that this will stop is when we cease to support that power structure. But it's going to take considerable sort of enlightenment of more and more people, which is happening, albeit slowly, to realize that most of what we think we know actually doesn't withstand scrutiny. Hence my reference to the propaganda that was propagated through the Second World War is a repeat of what started in the First World War. So you have to understand 20th century history in order to understand what's going on now and realize that there is a direct connect between the structure and the results, which is this atrocity. The existing structure will not alleviate this. And it's not surprising that the international community says one thing and yet does another because the structure forces them to.
Thank you, Clive. And Charlotte, at this point, I'm sure the Palestinians in northern Gaza, they care little for reparations or justice or accountability. They just want this nightmare to stop. They want their kids to eat. They want to stop having their buildings shake and tremble through the night because of sounds of bombs and their children crying throughout the... I mean, what do we do for them? How do we comfort them, give them any sense of security, give them any sense of hope?
So on a basic level, that's true, right? Like Palestinians, like all other people, like all other humans, if they're being contended with this murderous force, this like absolutely really evil, horrific force that's just engaging in the most blatant and horrific forms of atrocities, that is just raining death and destruction wherever it can at any moment. Obviously, the most basic need that people have is to survive, to eat, to have a place to live, to have health care. And of course, we've seen the deliberate destruction and targeting of hospitals. We're seeing the deliberate destruction and targeting of schools. These are part and parcel of the genocide, to deny Palestinians access to health care, to education, to these basic aspects of like being able to sustain the society. So of course, people at a very basic level, they just want this to stop. At the same time, the Palestinian people in northern Gaza, throughout Gaza and throughout Palestine, and in exile and diaspora have also been very clear that demanding that this stop immediately is not a precursor to accepting surrender. And it's actually a kind of courage and bravery that really everybody should just like kind of stop and respect with like an immense awe, because the fact is that Palestinians have not given up on actual change, on actual accountability, on actually bringing the Zionist regime to justice. I mean, they might not be concerned with the next case that's going to be filed in international court. But there is a fundamental refusal to surrender and a refusal to give up and a refusal to stop the resistance despite all of the crimes and despite all of the massacres. And what that has to speak to us to do is to step up everything that we're doing, to escalate our campaigns, to escalate our struggle, because if we are going out and protesting in the streets, this is important to show our dissent, but it's not enough. It's not sufficient so long as the war machine of imperialism is continuing to move forward. When we're seeing things happening, like the actions of Palestine Action demonstrators in Britain, who have actually shut down several facilities of Elbit Systems, this Zionist war machine manufacturer, those are incredible actions that are, you know, actually bringing a material stop to the war machine. When we're seeing the actions of activists in Spain and internationally who are making sure that ships carrying military equipment, or in Turkey, get that ships carrying military equipment to the Zionist regime get blocked, this is small in comparison to what we see Yemen doing, shutting down the supply lines of genocide in the Red Sea. But it is a material method of participating in this struggle and not allowing these crimes to continue to happen, because we can't sit back and watch. We have to take an active role, especially in the heart of the Imperial Core, where these crimes are being planned, funded, and organized and armed.
And Clive, earlier, thank you for that, Charlotte. Clive, earlier, Charlotte, she referenced U.S. elections. My question to you, many say when it comes to Israel or it comes to the Palestinians, what we have seen as of late, nothing will change under a Trump presidency. But many argue that, in fact, they feel things will get much worse as Netanyahu basically sees the region of West Asia through Netanyahu's lenses, because he knows very little about historical facts and the region. How do you see a Trump presidency impacting this genocide in Gaza?
Well, I've been asked on a couple of occasions what effect the U.S. election would have, and I don't see that a change of president will in any way change the trajectory that the world is on at the moment, not least because Trump, far more visibly than any other American president, is a self-declared supporter of Israel. He has fully endorsed this idea that Hamas must be destroyed. But when the subtext is that Hamas is basically any male is identified as Israel as being Hamas, then the extension of that, or the logical conclusion of that, is that all Palestinians must be destroyed. So I'm not in any way hopeful that a change of presidency is going to change anything. Charlotte referred to Spain and other countries that are in some way seeking to give out the message that this is not acceptable. And whilst the UN and the international bodies that I referred to earlier have been impotent or even complicit in what's been going on over the last 70 years, it's quite notable that I think her name is Francesca Albanese, who's a special rapporteur on Palestinian, the Palestinian plight, for want of a better way of putting it. She's been quite outspoken. But I think it is incumbent on media throughout the world and anyone with any sort of voice to actually start dealing in reality. And I understand that people in European countries to in any way question the facts of the Holocaust is illegal. Now, the truth does not need a law to enforce it. And therefore, why is it illegal? And so many people are terrified of discussing this because of the repercussions. But we need to get to the truth of the reality in which we come from in terms of 20th century history and how this is extended and exacerbating what's going on now. Because otherwise this will not stop.
I want to thank you both for...
Greater Israel is the ambition, and that's what they've been working for ever since long before 1948.
Thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. Charlotte Cates joining us out of Vancouver, Canada, and Clive Menzies there joining us out of London, the UK. Viewers, this brings us to the end of this segment, your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hassan Al-Askari. When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari, alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the Infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and hardships in order to spread and promote and keep intact the high values and goals of the religion of Islam. Truly, there are so many countless favors that have been bestowed upon the Muslims by the divinely appointed Imams, the infallible and immaculate Imams, including Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Bo welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. You know, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, he really lived in an era which was really suffocating. The Abbasid Empire was superficially reaching its peak, but internally and from within, we find that it was crumbling. It was breaking apart. And there's various different factors and various different variables, for example, that we find that are indicators that from within the Abbasid Empire was breaking apart. But of course, superficially, it seemed like they were at the peak of their power. Still, we find that because the Abbasid Empire knew that from within it was breaking apart and it could not sustain its empire for much longer, they came down incredibly hard upon Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam and his followers and his network of representatives in order to try to prevent them from acquiring power or trying to prevent them from taking the reins of the Muslim Ummah as the Almighty Allah had ordained for it to happen. So in one of these conversations, of course, that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam has with a companion, he says that whoever loves us will be with us in the highest position. Now, he can be talking about both in this world and the hereafter, or only the hereafter. But he says, whoever loves us will be with us in the highest position, and whoever deviates from us will be in the fire. So, based upon the second part of the statement, we can infer that the first part of the statement is also regarding the hereafter. And so, whoever loves us, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, will be with us in the highest position in the hereafter, and whoever deviates from us will be in the fires of hell. Now, this is something that is, I guess, a principle for our lives, is that whoever loves the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam, will be with them. But you have to understand what the true meaning of love is here. If you love somebody, you listen to them, you obey them, you follow them. And so likewise, in the same manner, if we love the Ahlul Bayt, and this is the love that they are speaking about, if you love them, then you will follow their orders, follow their commands, follow what they say, you know, which comes down to the things that are wajib that we must do, the obligatory things, and the things that are haram that are prohibited for us to do. Really, that is the main place where this action comes into play. The more we love them, the more we will act upon this. And of course, whoever deviates from them, which means deviates from their teachings, deviates from their guidance, which is rightly guided, divinely guided, then of course they will be in the fire. And anybody who follows those who deviate from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam will end up in the same place. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Askari alayhi as-salam. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Communication with the community was not easy during the days of the Imam. And of course, the community was prepared for it, because you see, from the days of the ninth Imam onwards, you know, when we talk about Niyabat and Vikalat of the Imams, this didn't only started with Ghaybat al-Sughra, it started with the days of, actually even before that, but it became more organized and vast. You know, the network of the representatives of the Imam was expanded during the ninth Imam onwards, especially during the days of the tenth Imam, to the extent that you can see the list of the wakala and the representatives of the Imam all the way from Afghanistan and northern area of that, Marv and Bukhara, all the way to Egypt. And this is where you see the extent of the Shia community. Maybe they were never in majority, but it seemed they were spread all over. And that is the network with that the 10th Imam, you know, had. And 11th Imam also basically inherited that network. And that is how the Shias were already being trained gradually. That a time will come where you will not be able to meet your Imam directly, face to face. And this is how you will be able to communicate with the Imam through the Naibin, through the, you know, representatives. And interestingly, the first special or the chief representative of the Imam of our time, Ajalallahu Ta'ala Faraju Sharif, is the one who had the vikala from the 10th Imam. And that position was maintained by the 11th Imam, and he becomes Naibi Awwal during the Ghaibat al-Sughra. And so this is what I would look to say, that this whole system of Niyabat and Vikalat did not just emerge automatically during the Ghaibat Sughra time. No, this was being, you know, the community was being prepared for that from earlier time. One of the means by which the 11th Imam was in communication with his followers was, of course, through the letters. People would write letters to him, give to their wakil. If they are far away, to those wakala who are close by, they will send it to the chief wakil of that time, and he will somehow find a way to reach to the Imam. They were actually, one of them, the first naib of the 12th Imam, during the days of the 11th Imam, actually even changed his profession. He started selling oil in big containers, going door to door. You know, those days you do not necessarily always go to the shops. You know, people come and bring things to the door. And the reason why he adopted that was because this would be an excuse for him to go to that alley or the street where Imam lived, and he would be, you know, taking containers in. And apparently, you know, people will say, this is the person who sells oil. But many of the containers would actually have, you know, letters from the Imam. And this is where you will see that when it comes to the sayings of our 11th Imam, in many cases you will see so-and-so wrote a letter to the Imam, and this was the response that he received.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
You Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Jordanian people continue to protest against the wars in Gaza and Lebanon, calling on Arab nations to unite in pressuring Israel into ending the ongoing genocide and daily massacres. The march organized by Jordan's Islamic movement urged immediate action to lift the blockade on Gaza.
400 days of siege, hunger and war, depriving our people in Gaza of medicine, food and water. Today we call on the Arab world, the international community and all people to rise up, to stop this war of extermination and to make their voices heard. Without forgetting that this entity's greed knows no bounds.
Participants warned of the regime's efforts to displace the residents of Gaza and the occupied West Bank as part of an expansionist project targeting Arab nations. They urged Arab countries to act decisively to halt these plans and called on the Jordanian government to sever all ties with the regime, including cancelling the Wadi Araba Treaty and agreements on gas and water.
This message is directed at the Arab and Islamic world and the international community. It is imperative to stop the violations and mass extermination in Gaza and Lebanon. We stand in solidarity with the resistance in Gaza and Lebanon, recognizing the profound sacrifices made by the Palestinian and Lebanese people.
The Zionist forces continue their massacres to achieve their objectives, aiming to eliminate the resistance in Palestine and extend their violations throughout the region. Their intent is not only to impose their will on the Palestinian resistance, but on the entire world. They reject resolutions and defy international consensus, while the resistance remains the only force standing in their way.
Protesters expressed solidarity with the resistance in Gaza and southern Lebanon, standing strong against the brutal aggression, while condemning the silence of the international community and the Arab world in the face of ongoing massacres and the targeting of civilians. The march was joined by political parties, national and Islamic figures, and the National Forum for Supporting the Resistance. Participants in today's march call on Arab nations to take a right stance, holding them accountable for Gaza's blockade and urging immediate action to end the Israeli genocide. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
The Yemeni capital, Sana'a, was once again the center stage of pro-Palestine and Lebanon resistance rallies. Yemeni people say these demonstrations are part of a growing movement which is contributing to a global shift in support of Palestine.
Today's protest is a military front in the path of Allah, and whoever has joined this demonstration, it is as if they have taken part in a military action.
My message to Trump or any world tyrant is, you will not be able to stop our stance and support for our brothers in Palestine.
While protests remain a powerful front in the resistance against Israel and U.S. imperialism, Yemen's military efforts are also reaching new heights in capability.
The missile unit of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a specific military operation targeting the Nevatim airbase in Negev region, southern occupied Palestine, with hypersonic ballistic missile Palestine 2 that has reached its target. Thanks be to Allah. With the help of Allah Almighty, our air defenses succeeded in shooting down an American MQ-9 aircraft while it was carrying out hostile missions in the airspace of Al-Jaf Governorate at dawn on Friday.
The Friday protesters emphasize that their cause transcends U.S. politics and that they are undeterred by who occupies the White House. They believe real change in the West Asia region depends on the strength of the axis of resistance.
For 14 months, Friday demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have continued, swelling in size and in strength. Ansarullah's leader calls these rallies a powerful front line equal to any battlefield in the fight against Israel. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Iran's Deputy Defense Minister pays a two-day official visit to Islamabad. He has met with top Pakistani officials to explore avenues for deepening military and security ties. The visiting Iranian defense official emphasized the importance of strengthening bilateral coordination to effectively secure the porous border with Pakistan, a critical priority for both nations due to their shared security challenges. While assuring Tehran of its full support to increase collaboration on regional peace and security, Islamabad expressed serious concerns over Israel's recent military aggression against Iran, describing it as a violation of international law and an infringement on Iran's sovereignty. To bolster defense, industrial, and technological cooperation with Pakistan, Iran will participate in the International Defense Exhibition, scheduled to be held next week in Karachi.
The shared resolve between Tehran and Islamabad to fortify their defense and security partnership is expected to play a key role in advancing regional stability and sustainable development. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
At South Korea's National Assembly Wednesday, the export of weapons to Israel came under the scrutiny of lawmakers as Israel's genocide in Gaza continues. Researchers outlined the complicity of several nations, particularly the United States.
The United States, which provides the largest amount of weapons to Israel, has provided more than 50,000 tons of weapons and military equipment since October 7, 2023. Germany, the UK, Canada, France, Italy, Australia, South Korea, and other countries are also supporting massacre by arming Israel with bombs, bullets, jets, and fuel.
Seoul has seen weekly demonstrations in support of Palestine over the past year. Still, South Korea continues to export weapons to Israel worth millions of dollars. Recognizing those guilty may bring change.
If more countries take measures within their own countries, wouldn't that be a way to pressure the United States? That's why we're filing criminal charges against Israeli war criminals in South Korea. And even though South Korea isn't doing much, there are still declarations to stop exporting weapons to Israel.
Legal decisions condemning Israel's occupation and genocide from the International Criminal Court and International Court of Justice seem to be inspiring legal authorities within countries around the world. Charges of complicity in Israel's genocide of Palestinians are also extending beyond states. A panel of 30 UN experts warned arms and ammunition manufacturers that by exporting weapons to Israel, together with their investors, they may be complicit in serious violations of international human rights law. Supporters of Palestine are pressing forward with more demonstrations demanding an end to Israel's genocide, with a global day of action slated for November 16th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a humanitarian artistic initiative, artists from Jordan and other Arab countries have presented a powerful collection of paintings portraying the suffering of children in Gaza amidst the Israeli aggression on the blockaded territory. This exhibition, titled Painting Joy, was organized by the Jordanian Association of Fine Artists.
We organized this exhibition in collaboration with the Ministry of Culture and as part of the Jerash Festival, with all proceeds dedicated to supporting our brothers and sisters in Gaza. Jordanian and Arab artists stand in solidarity with the people of Gaza and Lebanon.
Certainly, the tragedy unfolding in Gaza right now calls for empathy and support from the entire world. As fine artists, our mission is to help the world grasp the depth of suffering endured by our brothers and sisters in Gaza and Lebanon. We express this tragedy in the way we know best, through our art.
Released Palestinian prisoner Isra Jabis attended as the guest of honor, showcasing several of her own artworks and introducing her debut book in pain. Her presence highlighted the vital role of art in expressing solidarity with just causes.
Powerful messages are conveyed through each painting,
One piece of art reflects my own pain as Isra Jabi's, while another tells the story of a Palestinian woman during the war who was exposed to toxic fumes and gave birth to a deformed baby.
The participating artists highlighted art's role in expressing empathy for humanitarian struggles, emphasizing that the Jordanian people have always stood in solidarity with Palestine as part of the Arab country's enduring commitment to the Palestinian cause. The exhibition featured 39 diverse paintings reflecting a wide array of artistic styles.
Art is a powerful tool for change, delivering important messages to the world. This exhibition highlights the suffering of Gaza's children and calls for international and Arab communities to stand in solidarity. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
UNRWA was founded with the primary aim of addressing the needs of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were forcibly expelled from their homes and villages. Established in 1949, in the aftermath of the Nakba, UNRWA has been pivotal in providing essential services to millions of Palestinian refugees. For over seven decades, it has worked tirelessly to deliver education, healthcare, and social services to refugees in the Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank, and the neighboring countries such as Lebanon and Jordan. Reports indicate that UN staff and warehouses are being directly targeted, leading to damage to two-thirds of the agency's facilities. With a significant increase in displacement and infrastructure destruction, civilians are increasingly reliant on the agency's limited services. The Israeli regime has recently enacted new laws that make it impossible for UNRWA to operate. This development follows funding cuts to the agency from several countries, including the United States. Critics argue that these actions undermine the humanitarian principles and worsen the suffering of already vulnerable Palestinian population, leading to catastrophic consequences for health, education, and social support in a region already grappling with significant hardships.
In these critical times and as the dire situation evolves, the fate of UNRWA and its vital services are hanging in the balance, raising urgent questions about the future of the Palestinian refugees and the broader implications for the regional stability. Ghada Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah.
The main market in the city of Khan Yunis, where people come every day in search of food they can afford to satisfy their hunger. Famine has again returned here as Israel continues to block crossings and restrict the entry of aid and basic necessities in the southern parts. This, as Israel repeatedly says, is thus the safe haven for those remaining in the besieged north.
I have been displaced here since May, and let me say that the situation here in the south is no better than in the north. We lack basic needs such as food, flour, and vegetables. Do you see this tomato? I can't even afford this one tomato, as the prices of available items and vegetables are astronomical. We receive no aid as the crossings are closed. It would cost us a fortune to get one decent meal.
With the market shelves and vendors empty except for a few items available at astronomical prices, the Gazans find themselves looking for whatever they can afford to satisfy their hunger, even it was rotten bread.
We were displaced from Jabalia because we were told that the situation here in the south was better. But we have been struggling every day for more than a year in search of food to feed our children. We can barely find any flour to make some bread. I wish we had stayed in the north and never left.
According to the United Nations World Food Programme, the ongoing crisis could escalate into famine. But Gazans say this is the least that could be said to describe the situation here. What is happening is systematic starvation to kill those who survive the bombardments.
My son asked this morning to make him some salad. Can you imagine? He just asked for a salad, and I couldn't fulfill his wish because we can't afford vegetables. They are scarce and extremely expensive. I own this vendor, but there is nothing to sell because products are banned and people can't afford what is available. And they certainly do not receive aid as Israel prevents it.
Whether in the north of Gaza or here in the south, Palestinians continue to struggle to secure a decent meal for their children. This daily suffering persists while Israel's genocides claim their lives without allowing them the dignity of dying without hunger. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
Yemen's naval forces are creating their own parting of the Red Sea to help liberate Palestinians from Israel's genocide in Gaza. The maritime divide by Yemen aims to block vessels linked to Israel while allowing those without ties pass unhindered. According to military officials, Israeli-linked companies are currently trying to fabricate digital data and information to hide their association with Israel so they can pass Yemeni waters.
The Zionists are trying to deceive the world by using unlawful tactics to change the ownership names of vessels and companies associated with them. This will not work. We have enough information, and we know all the names and companies linked to the Zionist entity.
Through advanced data-gathering methods, Yemen's ground and naval forces are equipped to take precise actions against vessels engaging in deceptive practices.
Yemen's intelligence and security have reached advanced capabilities. We can obtain any information we want from any source. All information is then submitted to decision makers, who make informed final decisions.
The Red Sea, a strategic yet contested waterway, has become an advantage point for Yemen as they intercept potential threats and block Israeli-linked vessels from advancing undetected. Officials emphasized that fortified naval defenses serve as a crucial line of resistance against covert U.S. and Israeli incursions.
Yemeni territorial waters are considered to be the most strategic yet vulnerable access point the enemy could use against Yemen. Therefore, it was a top priority to advance our naval capabilities, and now these waters have become our strongest weapon, which we are using against the enemy.
Yemen's operations in the Red Sea are specifically aimed at pressuring Israel to end its genocide in Palestine, as well as its military offensive in Lebanon. Yemen's armed forces say they are now in a stronger position than ever to continue anti-Israel operations in the Red Sea and even beyond. Meanwhile, it seems that Yemen will need to rely more on intelligence gathering in order to continue these calculated naval operations. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Rabbana Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mahdi, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala ashraf al-anbiya wal-mursaleen. Habib qulubana wa tabib nufusana abil qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin al-ma'asumin al-mukarnamin. Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's an honor, a blessing for me to take part in this beautiful program of spending time on Sahifa Sajjadiyya, the legacy of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, Imam Sajjad, and to be able to ponder and contemplate upon the teachings that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has left us, we have inherited from him, in the format of dua and the platform of worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The 16th dua of Sahifa Sajjadiyah focuses on his supplication when he asked release from his sins or pleaded in seeking pardon for his defects. At the very beginning of this dua, in the early phases of this dua, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam remembers, first of all, calls Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by the most beautiful titles in respect to the most difficult situation everybody goes through. We got to the point that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, in the beginning of this 16th dua, says, وَيَا فَرَجَ كُلَّ مَكْرُوبٍ, O the relief of all who are downcast. كُلُّ مَكْرُوبٍ كَئِيبٍ and distressed. وَيَا غَوْثَ كُلَّ مَخْذُولٍ فَرِيدٍ, O aid of every